tag there that said, "Kitty Pan Kitty Litter. Use it. Throw it away. Sanitary." Yeah, it was. She'd been feeling punk, thank you, but she thought it might have been a, you know, sort of leftover from change of life. It was cancer. They opened her up, took a look, and sewed her right back up. 3 weeks later, she was dead. Hell of a hard thing for Ellen. I mean, she's only 20 years younger. "Yeah," he said. "So, she's out in Cleveland for a little while." "Yeah. Yeah."
They looked at each other and grinned shamefacedly over the fact of death.
"How is it?" he asked. "Out there in Northside." "Well, I'll tell you the truth, Bart. Nobody seems very friendly."
"No?
You know Ellen works down at the bank?"
"Yeah, sure."
"Well, a lot of the girls used to have a carpool. I used to let Ellen have the car every Thursday. That was her part. There's a pool out in Northside into the city, but all the women who use it are part of some club that Ellen can't join unless she's been there at least a year."
"That sounds pretty damn close to discrimination, Jack."
"Yeah, fuck them," Jack said angrily. "Ellen wouldn't join their goddamn club if they crawl up the street on their hands and knees. I got her own car. A used Buick. She loves it. Should have done it 2 years ago."
"How's the house?"
"It's fine," Jack said and sighed. "The electricity's high, though. You should see our bill. That's no good for people with a kid in college."
They shuffled. Now that Jack's anger had passed, the shame-faced grin was back on his face. He realized that Jack was almost pathetically glad to see someone from the neighborhood, and was prolonging the moment. He had a sudden vision of Jack knocking around at the new house, the sound from the TV filling the rooms with phantom company, his wife 1,000 miles away seeing her mother into the ground.
"Listen, why don't you come back to the house?" he asked. "We'll have a couple of six-packs and listen to Howard Cosell explain everything that's wrong with the NFL.
"Hey, that'd be great.
Just let me call Mary after we check out."
He called Mary, and Mary said okay. She said she would put some frozen pastries in the oven and then go to bed so she wouldn't give Jack her cold.
"How does he like it out there?" she asked.
"Okay, I guess. Mare, Ellen's mother died. She's out in Cleveland for the funeral. Cancer."
"Oh, no."
"So I thought Jack might like the company, you know."
"Sure, of course."
She paused.
"Did you tell him we might be neighbors before long?"
"No," he said. "I didn't tell him that."
"You ought to. It bites your rebob."
"Sure. Goodbye, Mary."
"Bye."
"Take some aspirin before you go to bed."
"I will."
"Bye."
"Bye, George."
She hung up. He looked at the phone, chilled. She only called him that when she was very pleased with him. Fred and George had been Charlie's game originally.
He and Jack Hobart went home and watched the game. They drank a lot of beer, but it wasn't so good. When Jack was getting into his car to go home at 12:15, he looked up bleakly and said,
"That goddamn highway. That's what fucked up the works."
It sure did.
He thought Jack looked old, and it scared him. Jack was about his age.
"You keep in touch, Bart."
"I will."
They grinned hollowly at each other, a little drunk, a little sick. He watched Jack's car until its taillights had disappeared down the long, curving hill. November 27, 1973. He was a little hungover and a little sleepy from staying up so late. The sound of the laundry washers kicking onto the extract cycle seemed loud in his ears, and the steady thump hiss of the shirt presses and the ironer made him want to wince. Freddy was worse. Freddy was playing the very devil today.
"Listen," Fred was saying, "this is your last chance, my boy. You've still got all afternoon to get over to Monahan's office. If you let it wait until 5 o'clock, it's going to be too late."
"The option doesn't run out until midnight.
Sure, it doesn't. But right after work, Monahan is going to feel a pressing need to go see some relatives in Alaska. For him, it means the difference between a $45,000 commission and $50,000, the price of a new car. For that kind of money, you don't need a pocket calculator. For that kind of money, you might discover relatives in the sewer system under Bombay. But it didn't matter. It had gone too far. He had let the machine run without him too long. He was hypnotized by the coming explosion, almost lusted for it. His belly groaned in its own juices. He spent most of the afternoon in the washroom, watching Ron Stone and Dave run test loads with one of the new laundry products. It was loud in the washroom. The noise hurt his tender head, but it kept him from hearing his thoughts. After work, he got his car out of the parking lot. Mary had been glad to let him have it for the day, since he was seeing about their new house, and drove through downtown and through Norton. In Norton, blacks stood around on street corners and outside bars. Restaurants advertised different kinds of soul food. Children hopped and danced on chalk sidewalk grids. He saw a pimp-mobile, a huge pink Eldorado Cadillac, pull up in front of an anonymous brownstone apartment building. The man who got out was a Wilt Chamberlain-sized black, in a white planter's hat and a white ice cream suit with pearl buttons and black platform shoes with huge gold buckles on the sides. He carried a malacca stick with a large ivory ball on the top. He walked slowly, majestically, around to the hood of the car, where a set of caribou antlers were mounted. A tiny silver spoon hung on a silver chain around his neck and winked in the thin autumn sun. He watched the man in the rearview mirror as the children ran to him for sweets. 9 blocks later, the tenements thinned to ragged, open fields that were still soft and marshy. Oily water stood between hummocks and puddles, their surfaces flat, deadly rainbows. On the left, near the horizon, he could see a plane landing at the city's airport. He was now on Route 16, traveling past the exurban sprawl between the city and the city limits. He passed McDonald's, Shakey's, Nino's Steak Pit. He passed a dairy freeze and the Naughty Time Motel, both closed for the season. He passed the Norton Drive-In, where the marquee said, "Fry, Sat, Sun." Restless wives. Some came running. Rated X. 8-ball. He passed a bowling alley and a driving range that was closed for the season. Gas stations, 2 of them, with signs that said, "Sorry, no gas." It was still 4 days until they got their gasoline allotments for December. He couldn't find it in himself to feel sorry for the country as a whole, as it went into the science fiction-style crisis. The country had been pigging petroleum for too long to warrant his sympathy, but he could feel sorry for the little men, with their peckers caught in the swing of a big door. A mile farther on, he came to Magliori's Used Cars. He didn't know what he had expected, but he felt disappointed. It looked like a cut-rate, fly-by-night operation. Cars were lined up on the lot facing the road under looped lines of flapping banners, red, yellow, blue, green, that had been tied between light standards that would shine down on the product at night. Prices and slogans soaked on the windshields. $795, runs good, and $550, good transportation. And on a dusty old Valiant with flat tires and a cracked windshield, $75. Mechanics special. A salesman wearing a gray-green topcoat was nodding and smiling noncommittally as a young kid in a red silk jacket talked to him. They were standing by a blue Mustang with Cancer of the Rocker panels. The kid said something vehement and thumped the driver's side door with the flat of his hand. Rust flaked off in a small flurry. The salesman shrugged and went on smiling. The Mustang just sat there and got a little older. There was a combination office and garage in the center of the lot. He parked and got out of his car. There was a lift in the garage, and an old Dodge with giant fins was up on it. A mechanic walked out from under holding a muffler in both grease-gloved hands like a chalice.
"Say, hey, you can't park there, mister. That's in the right-of-way."
"Where should I park?"
Take it around back if you're going in the office.
He drove the LTD around to the back, creeping carefully down the narrow way between the corrugated metal side of the garage and a row of cars. He parked behind the garage and got out. The wind, strong and cutting, made him wince. The heater had disarmed his face, and he had to squint his eyes to keep them from tearing. There was an automobile junkyard back here. It stretched for acres, amazing the eye. Most of the cars had been gutted of parts, and now they sat on their wheel rims or axles like the victims of some awful plague, who were too contagious to even be dragged to the dead pit. Grills with empty headlight sockets gazed at him raptly. He walked back out front. The mechanic was installing the muffler. An open bottle of Coke was balanced on a pile of tires to his right. He called to the mechanic.
"Is Mr. Magliori in?"
Talking to mechanics always made him feel like an asshole. He had gotten his first car 24 years ago, and talking to mechanics still made him feel like a pimply teenager. The mechanic looked over his shoulder and kept working his socket wrench.
"Yeah, him and Mancy, both in the office."
"Thanks."
"Sure."
He went into the office. The walls were imitation pine, the floor muddy squares of red and white linoleum. There were two old chairs with a pile of tattered magazines between them. Outdoor life, Field and Stream, True Argosy. No one was sitting in the chairs. There was one door, probably leading to an inner office, and on the left side a little cubicle like a theater box office. A woman was sitting in there, working an adding machine. A yellow pencil was poked into her hair. A pair of harlequin glasses hung against her scant bosom, held by a rhinestone chain. He walked over to her, nervous now. He wet his lips before he spoke.
"Excuse me."
She looked up.
"Yes?"
He had a crazy impulse to say, "I'm here to see Sally One-Eye, bitch. Shake your tail." Instead, he said,
"I have an appointment with Mr. Magliori."
"You do?"
She looked at him warily for a moment, and then riffled through some slips on the table beside the adding machine. She pulled one out.
"Your name is Dawes. Barton Dawes."
"That's right."
"Go right in."
She stretched her lips at him and began to peck at the adding machine again. He was very nervous. Surely they knew he had conned them. They were running some kind of midnight auto sales here. That much had been obvious from the way Mancy had spoken to him yesterday. And they knew he knew. Maybe it would be better to go right out the door, drive like hell to Monahan's office, and maybe catch him before he left for Alaska, or Timbuktu, or wherever he would be leaving for.
"Finally,"
Freddy said.
"The man shows some sense."
He walked over to the door in spite of Freddy, opened it, and stepped into the inner office. There were two men. The one behind the desk was fat and wearing heavy glasses. The other was razor-thin and dressed in a salmon-pink sports coat that made him think of Vinny. He was bending over the desk. They were looking at a J.C. Whitney catalog. They looked up at him. Magliori smiled from behind his desk. The glasses made his eyes appear faded and enormous, like the yolks of poached eggs.
"Mr. Dawes."
"That's right."
"Glad you could drop by. Want to shut the door?"
"Okay."
He shut it. When he turned back, Magliori was no longer smiling. Neither was Mancy. They were just looking at him, and the room temperature seemed to have gone down 20 degrees.
"Okay," Magliori said. "What is this shit?"
"I wanted to talk to you."
"I talk for free, but not to shitbirds like you. You call up Pete and give him a line of crap about two El Dorados."
He pronounced it Eldorados.
"You talk to me, mister. You tell me what your act is."
Standing by the door, he said, "I heard maybe you sold things."
"Yeah, that's right. Cars. I sell cars."
"No," he said. Other stuff. Stuff like..."
He looked around at the fake pine-paneled walls. God knew how many agencies were bugging this place.
"Just stuff," he finished,
and the words came out on crutches.
"You mean stuff like dope and whores and off-track betting? Or did you want to buy a hitter to knock off your wife or your boss?"
Magliori saw him wince and laughed harshly.
"That's not too bad, mister. Not bad at all for a shitbird. That's the big what-if-this-place-is-bugged-act, right? That's number one at the police academy, am I right?"
"Look, I'm not a..." "Shut up," Manzi said. He was holding the J.C. Whitney catalog in his hands. His fingernails were manicured. He had never seen manicured nails exactly like that, except on TV commercials where the announcer had to hold the bottle of aspirin or something. "If Sal wants you to talk, he'll tell you to talk." He blinked and shut his mouth. This was like a bad dream.
"You guys get dumber every day," Magliori said. "That's all right. I like to deal with dummies. I'm used to dealing with dummies. I'm good at it. Now, not that you don't know it, but this office is as clean as a whistle. We wash shit every week. I got a cigar box full of bugs at home. Contact mics, button mics, pressure mics, Sony tape recorders no bigger than your hand. They don't even try that much anymore. Now they send shitbirds like you."
He heard himself say, "I'm not a shitbird." An expression of exaggerated surprise spread across MacLeary's face. He turned to Manzi.
"Did you hear that? He said he wasn't a shitbird."
"Yeah, I heard that," Manzi said.
"Does he look like a shitbird to you?"
"Yeah, he does," Manzi said.
"Even talks like a shitbird, doesn't he?"
"Yeah."
"So, if you're not a shitbird," Magliori said, turning back to him, "what are you?"
"I'm," he began, not sure of just what to say. What was he? "Fred, where are you when I need you?"
"Come on, come on," Magliori said. "State police? City? IRS? FBI? He looked like prime FBI to you, Pete?"
"Yeah," Pete said.
"Not even the city police would send out a shitbird like you, mister. You must be FBI or a private detective. Which is it?"
He began to feel angry.
"Throw him out, Pete," Magliori said, losing interest.
Manzi started forward, still holding the J.C. Whitney catalog.
"You stupid dork,"
he suddenly yelled at Magliori.
"You probably see policemen under your bed. You're so stupid. You probably think they're home screwing your wife when you're here."
Magliori looked at him, magnified eyes widening. Manzi froze, a look of unbelief on his face.
"Dork,"
Magliori said, turning the word over in his mouth the way a carpenter will turn a tool he doesn't know over in his hands.
"Did he call me a dork?"
He was stunned by what he had said. "Now take him around back," Manzi said, starting forward again.
"Hold it!"
Magliori breathed. He looked at him with honest curiosity.
"Did you call me a dork?"
"I'm not a cop," he said. "I'm not a crook either. I'm just a guy that heard you sold stuff to people who had the money to buy it. Well, I've got the money. I didn't know you had to say the secret word, or have a Captain Midnight decoder ring, or all that silly shit. Yes, I called you a dork. I'm sorry I did, if it will stop this man from beating me up. I'm..." He wet his lips, and could think of no way to continue. Magliori and Manzi were looking at him with fascination, as if he had just turned into a Greek marble statue before their very eyes.
"Dork," Magliori breathed. "Frisk this guy, Pete."
Pete's hands slapped his shoulders and he turned around. "Put your hands on the wall," Manzi said, his mouth beside his ear. He smelled like Listerine.
"Feet out behind you, just like on the cop shows."
"I don't watch the cop shows," he said, but he knew what Manzi meant, and he put himself in the frisk position. Manzi ran his hands up his legs, patted his crotch with all the impersonality of a doctor, slipped a hand into his belt, ran his hands up his sides, slipped a finger under his collar.
"Clean,"
Manzi said.
"Turn around, you," Magliori said.
He turned around. Magliori was still regarding him with fascination.
"Come here."
He walked over. Magliori tapped the glass top of his desk. Under the glass, there were several snapshots. A dark woman who was grinning into the camera with sunglasses pushed back on top of her wiry hair. Olive-skinned kids splashing in a pool. Magliari himself, walking along the beach in a black bathing suit, looking like King Farouk, a large collie at his heel.
"Dump out," he said.
"Huh?"
"Everything in your pockets. Dump it out."
He thought of protesting, then thought of Mansi, who was hovering just behind his left shoulder. He dumped out. From his topcoat pockets, the stubs of the tickets from the last movie he and Mary had gone to, something with a lot of singing in it, he couldn't remember the name, he took off his topcoat. From his suit coat, a Zippo lighter with his initials, BGD, engraved on it, a package of flints, a single Phillies cheroot, a tin of Phillips Milk of Magnesia tablets, a receipt from A&S Tires, the place that had put on his snow tires. Mansi looked at it and said with some satisfaction,
"Christ, you got burned."
He took off his jacket, nothing in his shirt breast pocket but a ball of lint. From the right front pocket of his pants he produced his car keys and 40 cents in change, mostly in nickels. For some reason he had never been able to fathom, nickels seemed to gravitate to him. There was never a dime for the parking meter, only nickels, which wouldn't fit. He put his wallet on the glass-top desk with the rest of his things. Magliari picked up the wallet and looked at the faded monogram on it. Mary had given it to him on their anniversary 4 years ago.
"What's the G for?" Magliari asked.
"George."
He opened the wallet and dealt the contents out in front of him like a solitaire hand. $43 in twenties and ones. Credit cards. Shell. Sunoco. Arco. Grants. Sears. Carey's Department Store. American Express. Driver's license. Social Security. A blood donor card, type A positive. Library card. A plastic flip folder. A photostated birth certificate card. Several old receipted bills, some of them falling apart along the fold seams from age. Stamped checking account deposit slips, some of them going back to June.
"What's the matter with you?" Magliari asked irritably. "Don't you ever clean out your wallet? You load a wallet up like this and carry it around for a year, and wallet's hurting."
He shrugged. "I hate to throw things away."
He was thinking that it was strange how Magliari calling him a shitbird had made him angry, but Magliari criticizing his wallet didn't bother him at all. Magliari opened the flip folder, which was filled with snapshots. The top one was of Mary. Her eyes crossed, her tongue popped out of the camera. An old picture. She had been slimmer then.
"This is your wife?"
"Yeah."
"Bet she's pretty when there ain't a camera stuck in her face."
He flipped up another one and smiled.
"Your little boy? I got one about that age. Can he hit a baseball? Oh, wacko! I guess he can."
"That was my son, yes. He's dead now."
"Too bad. Accident?"
"Brain tumor."
Magliari nodded and looked at the other pictures. Fingernail clippings of a life. The house on Crestellan Street West. He and Tom Granger standing in the laundry washroom. A picture of him at the podium of the Launderers' Convention the year it had been held in the city. He had introduced the keynote speaker. A backyard barbecue with him standing by the grill in a chef's hat and an apron that said, "Dad's cookin', Mom's lookin'." Magliari put the flip folder down, bundled the credit cards into a pile, and gave them to Mansi.
"Have them photocopied," he said. "And take one of those deposit slips. His wife keeps the checkbook under lock and key, just like mine."
Magliari laughed. Mansi looked at him skeptically. "Are you going to do business with this shitbird?"
"Don't call him a shitbird, and maybe he won't call me a dork again."
He uttered a wheezy laugh that ended with unsettling suddenness.
"You just mind your business, Petey. Don't tell me mine."
Mansi laughed, but exited in a modified stalk. Magliari looked at him when the door was closed. He chuckled. He shook his head.
"Dork," he said. "By God, I thought I'd been called everything."
"Why is he going to photocopy my credit cards?"
"We have part of a computer. No one owns all of it. People use it on a time-sharing basis. If a person knows the right codes, that person can tap into the memory banks of over 50 corporations that have city business. So I'm going to check on you. If you're a cop, we'll find out. If those credit cards are fake, we'll find out. If they're real but not yours, we'll find that out too. But you got me convinced. I think you're straight. Dork.
He shook his head and laughed.
Was yesterday Monday? Mister, you're lucky you didn't call me a dork on Monday.
Can I tell you what I want to buy now?
You could. And if you were a cop with 6 recorders on you, you still couldn't touch me. It's called entrapment. But I don't want to hear it now. You come back tomorrow. Same time, same station. And I'll tell you if I want to hear it. Even if you're straight, I may not sell you anything. You know why?
Why? Magliore laughed.
Because I think you're a fruitcake, driving on 3 wheels, flying on instruments.
Why? Because I called you a name?
No, Magliore said. Because you remind me of something that happened to me when I was a kid, about my son's age. There was a dog that lived in the neighborhood where I grew up. Hell's Kitchen, in New York. This was before the Second World War, in the Depression. And this guy named Piazzi had a black mongrel bitch named Andrea, but everybody just called her Mr. Piazzi's dog. He kept her chained up all the time, but that dog never got mean. Not until this one hot day in August. It might have been 1937. She jumped a kid that came up to pet her and put him in the hospital for a month. 37 stitches in his neck. But I knew it was going to happen. That dog was out in the hot sun all day, every day, all summer long. In the middle of June, it stopped wagging its tail when kids came up to pet it. Then it started to roll its eyes. By the end of July, it would growl way back in its throat when some kid petted it. When it started doing that, I stopped petting Mr. Piazzi's dog. And the guy said, "What's the matter, Sally? You chicken shit?" And I said, "No, I ain't chicken shit, but I ain't stupid either. That dog's gone mean." And they all said, "Up your ass, Mr. Piazzi's dog don't bite. She never bit nobody. She wouldn't bite a baby that stuck its head down her throat." And I said, "You go on and pat her. There's no law that says you can't pat a dog, but I ain't gonna." And so they all go around saying Sally's chicken shit. Sally's a girl. Sally wants his mama to walk him past Mr. Piazzi's dog. You know how kids are.
I know, he said. Manzi had come back in with his credit cards and was standing by the door listening.
And one of the kids who was yelling the loudest was the kid who finally got it. Luigi Bronticelli. His name was. A good Jew, like me, you know.
Magliore laughed.
He went up to pet Mr. Piazzi's dog one day, in August, when it was hot enough to fry an egg on the sidewalk, and he ain't talked above a whisper since that day. He's got a barbershop in Manhattan, and they call him Whispering G.
Magliore smiled at him.
You remind me of Mr. Piazzi's dog. You ain't growling yet. But if someone was to pat you, you'd roll your eyes. And you stopped wagging your tail a long time ago. Pete, give this man his things.
Manzi gave him the bundle.
You come back tomorrow, and we'll talk some more, Magliore said.
He watched him putting things back into his wallet.
And you really ought to clean that mess out. You're racking that wallet all to shit.
Maybe I will, he said.
Pete, show this man out to his car.
Sure. He had the door open and was stepping out when Magliore called after him.
You know what they did to Mr. Piazzi's dog, mister? They took her to the pound and gassed her.
After supper, while John Chancellor was telling about how the reduced speed limit on the Jersey Turnpike had probably been responsible for fewer accidents, Mary asked him about the house.
Termites, he said.
Her face fell like an express elevator.
Oh, no good, huh?
Well, I'm going out again tomorrow. If Tom Granger knows a good exterminator, I'll take the guy out with me. Get an expert opinion. Maybe it isn't as bad as it looks.
I hope it isn't. A backyard and all?
She trailed off wistfully. Oh, you're a prince, Freddy said suddenly. A veritable prince. How come you're so good to your wife, George? Was it a natural talent, or did you take lessons?
Shut up, he said. Mary looked around startled.
What?
Oh, Chancellor, he said. I get so sick of gloom and doom from John Chancellor and Walter Cronkite and the rest of them.
You shouldn't hate the messenger because of the message, she said, and looked at John Chancellor with doubtful, troubled eyes.
I suppose so, he said, and thought, you bastard, Freddy.
Freddy told him not to hate the messenger for the message.
They watched the news in silence for a while. A commercial for a cold medicine came on, two men whose heads had been turned into blocks of snot. When one of them took the cold pill, the gray-green cube that had been encasing his head fell off in large lumps.
Your cold sounds better tonight, he said.
It is. Bart, what's the realtor's name?
Monahan, he said automatically.
No, not the man that's selling you the plant. The one that's selling the house.
Olson, he said promptly, picking the name out of an internal litter bag.
The news came on again. There was a report on David Ben-Gurion, who was about to join Harry Truman in that great secretariat in the sky.
How does Jack like it out there? She asked presently.
He was going to tell her Jack didn't like it at all, and heard himself saying, okay, I guess. John Chancellor closed out with a humorous item about flying saucers over Ohio. He went to bed at 10:30, and must have had the bad dream almost at once. When he woke up, the digital clock said 11:22 p.m. In the dream, he had been standing on a corner in Norton, the corner of Venner and Rice Street. He had been standing right under the street sign. Down the street, in front of a candy store, a pink pimpmobile with caribou antlers mounted on the hood had just pulled up. Kids began to run toward it from stoops and porches. Across the street, a large black dog was chained to the railing of a leaning brick tenement. A little boy was approaching it confidently. He tried to cry out, "Don't pet that dog! Go get your candy!" But the words wouldn't come out. As if in slow motion, the pimp in the white suit and the planter's hat turned to look. His hands were full of candy. The children who had crowded around him turned to look. All the children around the pimp were black, but the little boy approaching the dog was white. The dog struck, catapulting up from its haunches like a blunt arrow. The boy screamed and staggered backward, hands to his throat. When he turned around, the blood was streaming through his fingers. It was Charlie. That was when he had wakened. The dreams. The goddamn dreams. His son had been dead 3 years. November 28, 1973. It was snowing when he got up, but it had almost stopped by the time he got to the laundry. Tom Granger came running out of the plant in his shirt sleeves, his breath making short, stiff plumes in the cold air. He knew, from the expression on Tom's face, that it was going to be a crummy day.
"We've got trouble, Bart."
"Bad?"
"Bad enough. Johnny Walker had an accident on his way back from Holiday Inn with his first load. Guy in a Pontiac skidded through a red light on Diekman and hit him dead center. Kapow!"
He paused and looked aimlessly back toward the loading doors. There was no one there.
"The cops said Johnny was in a bad way."
"Holy Christ."
"I got out there 15 or 20 minutes after it happened. You know the intersection?"
"Yeah, yeah, it's a bitch."
Tom shook his head.
"If it wasn't so fucking awful, you'd have to laugh. It looks like somebody threw a bomb at a washerwoman. There's Holiday Inn sheets and towels everywhere. Some people were stealing them, the fucking ghouls. Can you believe what people will do? And the truck, Bart, there's nothing left from the driver's side door up, just junk. Johnny got thrown."
"Is he at Central?"
"No, St. Mary's. Johnny's a Catholic. Didn't you know that?"
"You want to drive over with me?"
"I better not. Ron's hollering for pressure on the boiler."
He shrugged, embarrassed.
"You know Ron. The show must go on."
"All right." He got back into his car and drove out toward St. Mary's Hospital. Jesus Christ, of all the people for it to happen to. Johnny Walker was the only person left at the laundry besides himself who had been working at the Blue Ribbon in 1953.
Johnny, in fact, went back to 1946. The thought lodged in his throat like an omen. He knew from reading the papers that the 784 extension was going to make the dangerous Diekman intersection pretty much obsolete. His name wasn't Johnny at all, not really. He was Corey Everett Walker. He had seen it on enough time cards to know that, but he had been known as Johnny even 20 years ago. His wife had died in 1956 on a vacation trip in Vermont. Since then, he had lived with his brother, who drove a sanitation truck for the city. There were dozens of workers at the Blue Ribbon who called Ron Stoneballs behind his back, but Johnny had been the only one to use it to his face and get away with it. He thought, if Johnny dies, I'm the oldest employee the laundry has got. Held over for a 20th record-breaking year. Isn't that a sketch, Fred? Fred didn't think so. Johnny's brother was sitting in the waiting room of the emergency wing. A tall man with Johnny's features and high complexion, dressed in olive work clothes and a black cloth jacket. He was twirling an olive-colored cap between his knees and looking at the floor. He glanced up at the sound of footsteps.
"You from the laundry?" he asked.
"Yes." "You're..." He didn't expect the name to come to him, but it did. "Arnie, right?"
"Yeah,
Arnie Walker." He shook his head slowly. "I don't know, Mr. Dawes. I don't know, Mr. Dawes.
I seen him in one of those examining rooms. He looked pretty banged up. He ain't a kid anymore. He looked bad."
"I'm very sorry," he said.
"That's a bad corner. It wasn't the other guy's fault. He just skidded in the snow. I don't blame the guy. They say he broke his nose, but that was all. It's funny the way those things work out, you know it?"
"Yes."
"I remember one time when I was driving a big rig for Hemingway. This was in the early 60s. And I was on the Indiana toll road, and I saw..."
The outer door banged open, and a priest came in. He stamped snow from his boots and then hurried up the corridor, almost running. Arnie Walker saw him, and his eyes widened and took on the glazed look of shock. He made a whining, gasping noise in his throat and tried to stand up. He put an arm around Arnie's shoulders and restrained him.
"Jesus!"
Arnie cried.
"He had his picks. Did you see it? He's going to give him the last rites. Maybe he's dead already. Johnny!"
There were other people in the waiting room, a teenage kid with a broken arm, an elderly woman with an elastic bandage around one leg, a man with his thumb wrapped in a giant dressing. They looked up at Arnie and then down self-consciously at their magazines. "Take it easy," he said meaninglessly.
"Let me go,"
Arnie said.
"I got to go see."
"Listen."
"Let me go!"
He let him go. Arnie Walker went around the corner and out of sight, the way the priest had gone. He sat in the plastic contour seat for a moment, wondering what to do. He looked at the floor, which was covered with black, slushy tracks. He looked at the nurse's station, where a woman was covering a switchboard. He looked out the window and saw that the snow had stopped. There was a sobbing scream from up the corridor, where the examining rooms were. Everybody looked up, and the same half-sick expression was on every face. Another scream, followed by a harsh, braying cry of grief. Everyone looked back at their magazines. The kid with the broken arm swallowed audibly, producing a small click in the silence. He got up and went out quickly, not looking back. At the laundry, everyone on the floor came over, and Ron Stone didn't stop them. "I don't know," he told them. "I never found out if he was alive or dead. You'll hear, I just don't know." He fled upstairs, feeling weird and disconnected.
"Do you know how Johnny is, Mr. Dawes?" Phyllis asked him.
He noticed for the first time that Phyllis, jaunty, blue-rinsed hair notwithstanding, was looking old.
"He's bad," he said. "The priest came to give him the last rites."
"Oh, what a dirty shame. And so close to Christmas."
"Did someone go out to Diekman to pick up his load?"
She looked at him a little reproachfully.
"Tom sent out Harry Jones. He brought it in 5 minutes ago."
"Good," he said.
But it wasn't good. It was bad. He thought of going down to the washroom and dumping enough hexlite into the washers to disintegrate all of it. When the extract ended and Pollock opened the machines, there would be nothing but a pile of gray fluff. That would be good. Phyllis had said something, and he hadn't heard.
What? I'm sorry.
I said that Mr. Ordner called. He wants you to call back right away. And a fellow named Harold Swinnerton. He said that cartridges had come in.
Harold?
And then he remembered. Harvey's gun shop. Only Harvey, like Marley, was as dead as a doornail.
Yes, right.
He went into his office and closed the door. The sign on his desk still said, "Think. It may be a new experience." He took it off the desk and dropped it into the wastebasket. Clunk. He sat behind his desk, took everything out of the in basket, and threw it into the wastebasket without looking at it. He paused and looked around the office. The walls were wood-paneled. On the left were two framed degrees, one from college, one from the Laundry Institute, where he had gone during the summers of 1969 and 1970. Behind the desk was a large blow-up of himself shaking hands with Ray Tarkington in the Blue Ribbon parking lot, just after it had been hot-topped. He and Ray were smiling. The laundry stood in the background, three trucks backed into the loading bay. The smokestack still looked very white. He had been in this office since 1967, over 6 years. Since before Woodstock, before Kent State, before the assassination of Robert Kennedy and Martin Luther King, since before Nixon. Years of his life had been spent between these four walls. Millions of breaths, millions of heartbeats. He looked around, seeing if he felt anything. He felt faintly sad. That was all. He cleaned out his desk, throwing away personal papers and his personal account books. He wrote his resignation on the back of a printed wash formula and slipped it into a laundry pay envelope. He left the impersonal things, the paper clips, the scotch tape, the big book of checks, the pile of blank time cards held together with rubber bands. He got up, took the 2 degrees off the wall, and threw them into the wastebasket. The glass covering the Laundry Institute diploma shattered. The squares where the degrees had hung all these years were a little brighter than the rest of the wall, and that was all. The phone rang, and he picked it up, thinking it would be Ordner. But it was Ron Stone calling from downstairs.
Bart?
Yeah.
Johnny passed away a half hour ago. I guess he never really had a chance.
I'm very sorry. I want to shut it down the rest of the day, Ron. Ron sighed.
That's best, I guess. But won't you catch hell from the big bosses?
I don't work for the big bosses anymore. I just wrote my resignation. There. It was out. That made it real. A dead beat of silence on the other end. He could hear the washers and the steady thumping hiss of the ironer, the mangler, they called it, on account of what would happen to you if you ever got caught in it.
I must have heard you wrong,
Ron said finally.
I thought you said...
I said it, Ron. I'm through. It's been a pleasure working with you and Tom and even Venny, when he could keep his mouth shut. But it's over.
Hey, listen, Bart, take it easy. I know this has got you upset.
It's not over, Johnny, he said, not knowing if it was true or not. Maybe he still would have made an effort to save himself, to save the life that had existed under a protective dome of routine for the last 20 years. But when the priest had walked quickly past them down the hall, almost running, to the place where Johnny lay dying or dead, and when Arnie Walker had made that funny whining noise high up in his throat, he had given up. Like driving a car in a skid, or fooling yourself that you were driving, and then just taking your hands off the wheel and putting them over your eyes. It's not over, Johnny, he repeated.
Well, listen... Listen,
Ron sounded very upset. Look, I'll talk to you later, Ron, he said, not knowing if he would or not. Go on. Have them punch out.
Okay. Okay, but...
He hung up gently. He took the phone book out of the drawer and looked in the yellow pages under Guns. He dialed Harvey's gun shop.
Hello, Harvey's.
This is Barton Dawes, he said.
All right. Those shells came in late yesterday afternoon.
I told you I'd have them in plenty of time for Christmas. 200 rounds.
Good. Listen, I'm going to be awfully busy this afternoon. Are you open tonight?
Open nights until 9, right up to Christmas.
Okay. I'll try to get in around 8. If not, tomorrow afternoon for sure.
Good enough. Listen, did you find out if it was Boca Rio?
Boca, oh, yes. Boca Rio, where his cousin Nick Adams would soon be hunting.
Boca Rio, yeah, I think it was. Jesus, I envy him. That was the best time I ever had in my life.
Shaky ceasefire holds, he said. A sudden image came to him of Johnny Walker's head mounted over Stefan Ordner's electric log fireplace, with a small, polished bronze plaque beneath, saying, Homo Laundromat, November 28, 1973, bagged on the corner of Diekman.
What was that?
Harry Swinnerton asked, puzzled.
I said, I envy him too, he said,
and closed his eyes. A wave of nausea raced through him. I'm cracking up, he thought. This is called cracking up.
Oh, well, I'll see you then.
Sure. Thanks again, Mr. Swinnerton. He hung up, opened his eyes, and looked around his denuded office again. He flicked the button on the intercom.
Phyllis?
Yes, Mr. Dawes.
Johnny died. We're going to shut it down.
I saw people leaving and thought he must have.
Phyllis sounded as if she might have been crying.
See if you can get Mr. Ordner on the phone before you go, will you?
Surely.
He swiveled around in his chair and looked out the window. A road grader, bright orange, was lumbering by with chains on its oversized wheels, lashing at the road. This is their fault, Freddy. All their fault. I was doing okay until those guys down at City Hall decided to rip up my life. I was doing fine, right, Freddy? Freddy? Fred? The phone rang, and he picked it up.
Dawes?
You've gone crazy, Steve Ordner said flatly. Right out of your mind.
What do you mean?
I mean that I personally called Mr. Monahan this morning at 9:30. The McCann people signed the papers on the Waterford plant at 9 o'clock. Now what the fuck happened, Barton?
I think we'd better discuss that in person.
So do I. And I think you ought to know that you're going to have to do some fast talking if you want to save your job.
Stop playing games with me, Steve.
What?
You've got no intention of keeping me on, not even as the sweeper. I've written my resignation already. It's sealed up, but I can quote it from memory. I quit. Signed, Barton George Dawes.
But why?
He sounded physically wounded. But he wasn't whining like Arnie Walker. He doubted if Steve Ordner had done any whining since his 11th birthday. Whining was the last resort of lesser men.
2 o'clock,
he asked.
2 is fine.
Goodbye, Steve.
Bart!
He hung up and looked blankly at the wall. After a while, Phyllis poked her head in, looking tired and nervous and bewildered beneath her smart, older-person hairdo. Seeing her boss sitting quietly in his denuded office did nothing to improve her state of mind.
Mr. Dawes, should I go? I'd be glad to stay if...
No. Go on, Phyllis. Go home.
She seemed to be struggling to say something else, and he turned around and looked out the window, hoping to spare them both embarrassment.
After a moment, the door snicked closed, very softly.
Downstairs, the boiler whined and died. Motors began to start up in the parking lot. He sat in his empty office, in the empty laundry, until it was time to go and see Ordner. He was saying goodbyes.
Ordner's office was downtown, in one of the new high-rise office buildings that the energy crisis might soon make obsolete. 70 stories high, all glass, inefficient to heat in winter, a horror to cool in summer. Amroco's offices were on the 54th floor. He parked his car in the basement parking lot, took the escalator up to lobby level, went through a revolving door and found the right bank of elevators. He rode up with a black woman who had a large afro. She was wearing a jumper and was holding a steno notebook.
"I like your afro," he said abruptly, for no reason.
She looked at him coolly, and said nothing. Nothing at all. The reception room of Stephen Ordner's office was furnished with free-form chairs and a red-headed secretary who sat beneath a reproduction of Van Gogh's Sunflowers. There was an oyster-colored shag rug on the floor. Indirect lighting. Indirect music. Piping Mantovani. The redhead smiled at him. She was wearing a black jumper, and her hair was bound with a hank of gold yarn.
"Mr. Dawes?"
"Yes."
"Go right in, please."
He opened the door and went right in. Ordner was writing something at his desk, which was topped with an impressive slab of lucite. Behind him, a huge window gave on a western view of the city. He looked up and put his pen down.
"Hello, Bart," he said quietly.
"Hello."
"Sit down."
"Is this going to take that long?" Ordner looked at him fixedly.
"I'd like to slap you," he said. "Do you know that? I'd like to slap you all the way around this office. Not hit you or beat you up, just slap you."
"I know that," he said, and did.
"I don't think you have any idea of what you threw away," Ordner said. "I suppose the McGann people got to you. I hope they paid you a lot, because I had you personally earmarked for an executive vice presidency in this corporation. That would have paid $35,000 a year to start. I hope they paid you more than that."
"They didn't pay me a cent."
"Is that the truth?"
"Yes."
"Then why, Bart? Why, in the name of God?"
"Why should I tell you, Steve?" He took the chair he was supposed to take, the supplicant's chair, on the other side of the big lucite-topped desk. For a moment, Ordner seemed to be at a loss. He shook his head the way a fighter will when he has been tagged, but not seriously.
"Because you're my employee. How's that for a start?"
"Not good enough."
"What does that mean?"
"Steve, I was Ray Tarkington's employee. He was a real person. You might not have cared for him, but you had to admit he was real. Sometimes when you were talking to him, he broke wind or burped or picked dead skin out of his ear. He had real problems. Sometimes I was one of them. Once, when I made a bad decision about billing a motel out in Crager Plaza, he threw me against a door. You're not like him. The blue ribbon is Tinker Toys to you, Steve. You don't care about me. You care about your own upward mobility, so don't give me that employee shit. Don't pretend you stuck your cock in my mouth and I bit it." If Wardner's face was a facade, there was no crack in it. His features continued to register modulated distress, no more.
"Do you really believe that?" Ordner asked.
"Yes. You only give a damn about the blue ribbon as it affects your status in the corporation, so let's cut the shit. Here." He slid his resignation across the lucite top of the desk. Ordner gave his head another little shake.
"And what about the people you've hurt, Bart? The little people. Everything else aside, you were in a position of importance."
He seemed to taste the phrase.
"What about the people at the laundry who are going to lose their jobs because there's no new plant to switch to?"
He laughed harshly and said, "You cheap son of a bitch. You're too fucking high to see down, aren't you?" Ordner colored. He said carefully,
"You better explain that, Bart."
"Every single wage earner at the laundry, from Tom Granger on down to Pollock in the washroom, has unemployment insurance. It's theirs. They pay for it. If you're having trouble with that concept, think of it as a business deduction, like a four-drink lunch at Benjamin's."
Stung, Ordner said, "That's welfare money, and you know it."
He reiterated, "You cheap son of a bitch." Ordner's hands came together and formed a double fist. They clenched together like the hands of a child that has been taught to say the Lord's Prayer by his bed.
"You were overstepping yourself, Bart."
"No, I'm not. You called me here. You asked me to explain. What did you want to hear me say? I'm sorry? I screwed up. I'll make restitution. I can't say that. I'm not sorry. I'm not going to make restitution. And if I screwed up, that's between me and Mary, and she'll never even know, not for sure."
Are you going to tell me I hurt the corporation? I don't think even you are capable of such a lie. After a corporation gets to a certain size, nothing can hurt it. It gets to be an act of God. When things are good, it makes a huge profit. And when times are bad, it just makes a profit. And when things go to hell, it takes a tax deduction. Now you know that.
Ordner said carefully, "What about your own future? What about Mary's?"
"You don't care about that. It's just a lever you think you might be able to use. Let me ask you something, Steve. Is this going to hurt you? Is it going to cut into your salary, into your yearly dividend, into your retirement fund?"
Ordner shook his head. "Go on home, Bart. You are not yourself."
"Why? Because I'm talking about you and not just about Bucks?"
"You're disturbed, Bart."
"You don't know," he said, standing up and planting his fists on the lucite top of Ordner's desk. "You're mad at me, but you don't know why. Someone told you that if a situation like this ever came up, you should be mad, but you don't know why."
Ordner repeated carefully, "You're disturbed."
"You're damn right I am. What are you?"
"Go home, Bart."
"No. But I'll leave you alone, and that's what you want. Just answer one question. For 1 second, stop being the corporation man and answer one question for me. Do you care about this? Does any of it mean a damn to you?"
Ordner looked at him for what seemed a long time. The city was spread out behind him like a kingdom of towers, wrapped in grayness and mist. He said, "No."
"All right," he said softly. He looked at Ordner without animosity. "I didn't do it to screw you, or the corporation."
"Then why? I answered your question. You answer mine. You could have signed on the Waterford plant. After that, it would have been someone else's worry. Why didn't you?"
He said, "I can't explain. I listened to myself. But people talk a different language inside. It sounds like the worst kind of shit if you try to talk about it, but it was the right thing."
Ordner looked at him unflinchingly. "And Mary?" He was silent. "Go home, Bart," Ordner said.
"What do you want, Steve?"
Ordner shook his head impatiently. "We're done, Bart. If you want to have an encounter session with someone, go to a bar."
"What do you want from me?"
"Only for you to get out of here and go home."
"What do you want from life, then? Where are you hooked into things?"
"Go home, Bart."
"Answer me! What do you want?"
He looked at Ordner nakedly. Ordner answered quietly, "I want what everyone wants. Go home, Bart." He left without looking back, and he never went there again. When he got to Magliori's used cars, it was snowing hard, and most of the cars he passed had their headlights on. His windshield wipers beat a steady back-and-forth tune, and beyond their sweep, snow that had been defrosted into slush ran down the safety glass like tears. He parked in back and walked around to the office. Before he went in, he looked at his ghostly reflection in the plate glass and scrubbed a thin pink film from his lips. The encounter with Ordner had upset him more than he would have believed. He had picked up a bottle of Pepto-Bismol in a drugstore and had chugged half of it on the way out there. "Probably won't shit for a week, Fred." But Freddy wasn't at home. Maybe he had gone to visit Monahan's relatives in Bombay. The woman behind the adding machine gave him a strained, speculative smile and waved him in. Magliori was alone. He was reading the Wall Street Journal, and when he came in, Magliori threw it across the desk and into the wastebasket. It landed with a rattling thump.
"It's going right to fucking hell," Magliori said, as if continuing an interior dialogue that had started some time ago. "All these stockbrokers and old women, just like Paul Harvey says. Will the president resign? Will he? Won't he? Will he? Is GE going to go bankrupt with the energy shortage? It gives me a pain in the ass.
Yeah, he said, but not sure of what he was agreeing to. He felt uneasy, and he wasn't totally sure Magliori remembered who he was. What should he say? I'm the guy who called you a dork, remember? Christ, that was no way to start.
Snowing harder, ain't it?
Yes, it is.
I hate the snow. My brother, he goes to Puerto Rico November 1st every year, stays until April 15th. He owns 40% of a hotel there. Says he has to look after his investment. Shit. He wouldn't know how to look after his own ass if you gave him a roll of Charmin. What do you want?
Huh? He jumped a little and felt guilty.
You came to me to get something. How can I get it for you if I don't know what it is?
When it was put with such abrupt baldness, he found it hard to speak. The word for what he wanted seemed to have too many corners to come out of his mouth. He remembered something he had done as a kid and smiled a little.
What's funny? Magliori asked with sharp pleasantness. With business the way it is, I could use a joke.
Once, when I was a kid, I put a yo-yo in my mouth, he said.
That's funny.
No, I couldn't get it out. That's funny. My mother took me to the doctor and he got it out. He pinched my ass, and when I opened my mouth to yell, he just yanked it out.
I ain't gonna pinch your ass, Magliori said.
What do you want, Dawes?
Explosives, he said.
Magliori looked at him. He rolled his eyes. He started to say something and slapped one of his hanging jowls instead.
Explosives?
Yes.
I knew this guy was a fruiter, Magliori told himself. I told Pete when you left, there goes a guy looking for an accident to happen. That's what I told him.
He said nothing. Talk of accidents made him think of Johnny Walker.
Okay, okay, I'll bite. What do you want explosives for? You going to blow up the Egyptian Trade Exposition? You going to skyjack an airplane? Or maybe just blow your mother-in-law to hell?
I wouldn't waste explosives on her, he said stiffly, and that made them both laugh, but it didn't break the tension.
So, what is it? Who have you got a hard-on against?
He said, I don't have a hard-on against anyone. If I wanted to kill somebody, I'd buy a gun. Then he remembered he had bought a gun, had bought two guns, and his Pepto-Bismol drug stomach began to roll again.
So why do you need explosives?
I want to blow up a road.
Magliori looked at him with measured incredulity. All his emotions seemed larger than life. It was as if he had adopted his character to fit the magnifying properties of his glasses.
You want to blow up a road? What road?
It hasn't been built yet. He was beginning to get a sort of perverse pleasure from this, and of course it was postponing the inevitable confrontation with Mary.
So you want to blow up a road that hasn't been built? I had you wrong, mister. You're not a fruitcake. You're a psycho. Can you make sense?
Picking his words carefully, he said, They're building a road that's known as the 784 extension. When it's done, the state turnpike will go right through the city. For certain reasons I don't want to go into, because I can't, that road has wrecked 20 years of my life. It's
because they're going to knock down the laundry where you work and your house?
How did you know that?
I told you I was going to check you. Did you think I was kidding? I even knew you were going to lose your job, maybe before you did.
No, I knew that a month ago, he said, not thinking about what he was saying.
And how are you going to do it? Were you planning to just drive past the construction, lighting fuses with your cigar, and throwing bundles of dynamite out of your car window?
No. Whenever there's a holiday, they leave all their machines at the site. I want to blow them all up. And all three of the new overpasses, I want to blow them up too.
Magliori goggled at him. He goggled for a long time. Then he threw back his head and laughed. His belly shook, and his belt buckle heaved up and down like a chip of wood riding a heavy swell. His laughter was full and hearty and rich.
He laughed until tears splurted out of his eyes, and then he produced a huge comic opera handkerchief from some inner pocket and wiped them. He stood watching Magliori laugh and was suddenly very sure that this fat man with the thick glasses was going to sell him the explosives. He watched Magliori with a slight smile on his face. He didn't mind the laughter. Today, laughter sounded good.
"Man, you're crazy, all right," Magliori said when his laughter had subsided to chuckles and hitchings. "I wish Pete could have been here to hear this. He's never going to believe it. Yesterday you called me a dork, and today—"
And he was off again, roaring his laughter, mopping his eyes with his handkerchief. When his mirth had subsided again, he asked,
"How are you going to finance this little venture, Mr. Dawes, now that you're no longer gainfully employed?"
That was a funny way to put it. No longer gainfully employed. When you said it that way, it really sounded true. He was out of a job. All of this was not a dream.
"I cashed in my life insurance last month," he said. "I'd been paying on a $10,000 policy for 10 years. I've got about $3,000.
"You've really been planning this for that long?"
"No," he said honestly. "When I cashed the policy in, I wasn't sure what I wanted it for."
"In those days, you were still keeping your options open, right? You thought you might burn the road, or machine gun it to death, or strangle it, or..."
"No. I just didn't know what I was going to do. Now I know."
"Well, count me out."
"What?" He blinked at Magliori, honestly stunned. This wasn't in the script. Magliori was supposed to give him a hard time in a fatherly sort of way, then sell him the explosive. Magliori was supposed to offer a disclaimer, something like, "If you get caught, I'll deny I ever heard of you."
"What did you say?" "I said no. N-O. That spells no."
He leaned forward. All the good humor had gone out of his eyes. They were flat, and suddenly small in spite of the magnification the glasses caused. They were not the eyes of a jolly Neapolitan Santa Claus at all.
"Listen," he said to Magliori, "if I get caught, I'll deny I ever heard of you. I'll never mention your name."
"The fuck you would. You'd spill your fucking guts and cop an insanity plea. I'd go up for life."
"No, listen."
"You listen," Magliori said. "You're funny up to a point. That point has been got to. I said no, I meant no. No guns, no explosive, no dynamite, no nothing. Because why? Because you're a fruitcake, and I'm a businessman. Somebody told you I could get things. I can get them all right. I've gotten lots of things for lots of people. I've also gotten a few things for myself. In 1946, I got a 2-to-5 bid for carrying a concealed weapon. Did 10 months. In 1952... I got a conspiracy rap, which I beat. In 1955, I got a tax evasion rap, which I also beat. In 1959, I got a receiving stolen property rap, which I didn't beat. I did 18 months in Castleton, but the guy who talked to the grand jury got life in a hole in the ground. Since 1959, I've been up 3 times. Case dismissed twice, rap beat once. They'd like to get me again because one more good one and I'm in for 20 years. No time off for good behavior. A man in my condition, the only part of him that comes out after 20 years is his kidneys, which they give to some Norton nigger in the welfare ward. This is some game to you. Crazy, but a game. It's no game to me. You think you're telling the truth when you say you keep your mouth shut, but you're lying. Not to me, to you. So the answer is flat no."
He threw up his hands.
"If it had been broads, Jesus, I would have given you 2 free just for that floor show you put on yesterday. But I ain't going for any of this."
"All right," he said.
His stomach felt worse than ever. He felt like he was going to throw up.
"This place is clean," Magliori said. "And I know it's clean. Furthermore, I know you're clean. Although God knows you're not going to be if you go on like this. But I'll tell you something. About 2 years ago,
This nigger came to me and he said he wanted explosives. He wasn't going to blow up something harmless like a road. He was going to blow up a fucking federal courthouse.
Don't tell me any more, he was thinking. I'm going to puke, I think. His stomach felt full of feathers, all of them tickling at once.
I sold him the goop, Magliari said. Some of this, some of that. We dickered, he talked to his guys, I talked to my guys. Money changed hands. A lot of money. The goop changed hands. They caught the guy and two of his buddies before they could hurt anyone, thank God. But I never lost a minute's sleep worrying, was he going to spill his guts to the cops, or the county prosecutor, or the FBI? You know why? Because he was with a whole bunch of fruitcakes. Nigger fruitcakes, and they're the worst kind. And a bunch of fruitcakes is a different proposition altogether. A single nut like you, he doesn't give a shit. He burns out like a light bulb. But if there are 30 guys and three of them get caught, they just zip up their lips and put things on the back burner.
All right, he said again. His eyes felt small and hot.
Listen, Magliori said a little more quietly. $3,000 wouldn't buy you what you want anyway. This is like the black market, you know what I mean? No pun intended. It would take 3 or 4 times that to buy the goop you need.
He said nothing. He couldn't leave until Magliori dismissed him. This was like a nightmare, only it wasn't. He had to keep telling himself that he wouldn't do something stupid in Magliori's presence, like trying to pinch himself awake.
Dawes?
What?
It wouldn't do any good anyway. Don't you know that? You can blow up a person. Or you can blow up a natural landmark, or you can destroy a piece of beautiful art, like that crazy shit that took a hammer to the Pietà, Mayor's dink rot off. But you can't blow up buildings or roads or anything like that. It's what all these crazy niggas don't understand. If you blow up a federal courthouse, the feds build 2 to take its place. 1 to replace the blown up one, and 1 just to rack up each and every black ass that gets busted through the front door. If you go around killing cops, they hire 6 cops for every 1 you killed, and every 1 of the new cops is on the prowl for dark meat. You can't win, Dawes. White or black. If you get in the way of that road, they'll plow you under, along with your house and your job.
I have to go now, he heard himself say thickly.
Yeah, you look bad. You need to get this out of your system. I can get you an old whore if you wanna. Old and stupid. You can beat the shit out of her if you want to. Get rid of the poison. I sort of like you, and...
He ran. He ran blindly, out the door and through the main office and out into the snow. He stood there shivering, drawing in great white freezing gulps of the snowy air. He was suddenly sure that Magliori would come out after him, collar him, take him back into the office, and talk to him until the end of time. When Gabriel trumpeted in the apocalypse, Sally One-Eye would still be patiently explaining the invulnerability of all systems everywhere and urging the old whore on him. When he got home, the snow was almost 6 inches deep. The plows had been by, and he had to drive the LTD through a crusted drift of snow to get in the driveway. The LTD made it no sweat. It was a good, heavy car. The house was dark. When he opened the door and stepped in, stamping snow off on the mat, it was also silent. Merv Griffin was not chatting with the celebrities.
Mary? He called.
There was no answer.
Mary!
He was willing to think she wasn't home until he heard her crying in the living room. He took off his top coat and hung it on its hanger in the closet. There was a small box on the floor under the hanger. The box was empty. Mary put it there every winter to catch drips. He had sometimes wondered, who cares about drips in a closet? Now the answer came to him, perfect in its simplicity. Mary cared. That's who. He went into the living room. She was sitting on the couch in front of the blank Zenith TV, crying. She wasn't using a handkerchief. Her hands were at her sides. She had always been a private weeper, going into the upstairs bedroom to do it, or if it surprised her, hiding her face in her hands or a handkerchief. Seeing her this way made her face seem naked and obscene, the face of a plane crash victim. It twisted his heart. "Mary," he said softly. She went on crying, not looking at him. He sat down beside her. "Mary," he said, "it's not as bad as that. Nothing is." But, he wondered.
"It's the end of everything," she said.
And the words came out splintered by her crying. Oddly, the beauty she had not achieved for good or lost for good was in her face now, shining. In this moment of the final smash, she was a lovely woman. "Who told you?"
"Everybody told me," she cried.
She still wouldn't look at him, but one hand came up and made a twisting, beating movement against the air before falling against the leg of her slacks.
"Tom Granger called. Then Ron Stone's wife called. Then Vincent Mason called. They wanted to know what was wrong with you. And I didn't know. I didn't know anything was wrong."
"Mary," he said, and tried to take her hand. She snatched it away, as if he might be catching.
"Are you punishing me?"
she asked, and finally looked at him.
"Is that what you're doing? Punishing me?"
"No," he said urgently. "Oh, Mary, no." He wanted to cry now, but that would be wrong. That would be very wrong.
"Because I gave you a dead baby? And then a baby with a built-in self-destruct? Do you think I murdered your son? Is that why?"
"Mary, he was our son."
"He was yours!"
she screamed at him. "Don't, Mary, don't." He tried to hold her, and she fought away from him.
"Don't you touch me!"
They looked at each other, stunned, as if they had discovered for the first time that there was more to them than they had ever dreamed of, vast white spaces on some interior map. "Mary, I can't help what I did. Please believe that." But it could have been a lie. Nonetheless, he plunged on. "If it had something to do with Charlie, it did. I've done some things I don't understand. I cashed in my life insurance policy in October. That was the first thing, the first real thing. But things had been happening in my mind long before that. But it was easier to do things than to talk about them. Can you understand that? Can you try?"
"What's going to happen to me, Barton? I don't know anything but being your wife. What's going to happen to me?"
"I don't know."
"It's like you raped me,"
she said, and began to cry again. "Mary, please don't do that anymore. Don't. Try not to do that anymore."
"When you were doing all those things, didn't you ever think of me? Didn't you ever think that I depend on you?"
He couldn't answer. In a strange, disconnected way, it was like talking to Magliori again. It was as if Magliori had beaten him home and put on a girdle and Mary's clothes and a Mary mask. What next? The offer of the old whore? She stood.
"I'm going upstairs. I'm going to lie down."
"Mary." She did not cut him off, but he discovered there were no words to follow that first. She left the room, and he heard her footsteps going upstairs. After that, he heard the creak of her bed as she lay down on it. After that, he heard her crying again. He got up and turned on the TV and jacked the volume so he wouldn't be able to hear it. On the TV, Merv Griffin was chatting with celebrities. Part 2. December. "Ah, love, let us be true to one another. For the world which seems to lie before us like a land of dreams, so various, so beautiful, so new, hath really neither joy, nor love, nor light, nor certitude, nor peace, nor help for pain. And we are here as on a darkling plain, swept with confused armies of struggle and flight, where ignorant armies clash by night." Matthew Arnold, Dover Beach. December 5, 1973. He was drinking his private drink, Southern Comfort and 7-Up, and watching some TV program he didn't know the name of. The hero of the program was either a plainclothes cop or a private detective, and some guy had hit him over the head. This had made the plainclothes cop or private detective decide that he was getting close to something. Before he had a chance to say what, there was a commercial for Gravy Train. The man in the commercial was saying that Gravy Train, when mixed with warm water, made its own gravy. He asked the audience if it didn't look just like beef stew.
To Barton George Dawes, it looked just like a loose bowel movement that somebody had done in a red dog dish.
The program came back on. The private eye, or plainclothes police detective, was questioning a black bartender who had a police record. The bartender said, "Dig." The bartender said, "Flake off." The bartender said, "Dude." He was a very hip bartender, all right, but Barton George Dawes thought that the private cop, or plainclothes investigator, had his number. He was quite drunk, and he was watching television in his shorts and nothing else. The house was hot. He had turned the thermostat to 78 degrees and had left it there ever since Mary left. What energy crisis? Fuck you, Dick. Also the horse you rode in on. Fuck Checkers, too. When he got on the turnpike, he drove at 70, giving the finger to motorists who honked at him to slow down. The president's consumer expert, some woman who looked as if she might have been a child star in the 1930s before passing time had turned her into a political hermaphrodite, had been on a public service program two nights ago talking about the ways you and I could save electricity around the house. Her name was Virginia Naur, and she was very big on different ways you and I could save energy, because this thing was a real bitch and we were all in it together. When the program was over, he had gone into the kitchen and turned on the electric blender. Mrs. Naur had said that blenders were the second biggest small appliance energy wasters. He had let the blender run on all night, and when he got up the next morning, yesterday morning, the motor had burned out. The greatest electricity waster, Mrs. Naur had said, were those little electric space heaters. He didn't have an electric space heater, but he had toyed with the idea of getting one so he could run it day and night until it burned up. Possibly, if he was drunk and passed out, it would burn him up too. That would be the end of the whole silly, self-pitying mess. He poured himself another drink and fell to musing over the old TV programs, the ones they had been running when he and Mary were still practically newlyweds, and a brand new RCA console model TV, your ordinary garden variety RCA console model black and white TV, was something to boggle over. There had been the Jack Benny program, and Amos and Nandy, those original jive-ass niggers. There was Dragnet, the original Dragnet, with Ben Alexander for Joe Friday's partner instead of that new guy, Harry somebody. There had been Highway Patrol with Broderick Crawford growling 10-4 into his mic, and everybody driving around in Buicks that still had portholes on the side. Your show of shows, your hit parade, with Giselle McKenzie singing things like Green Door and Stranger in Paradise. Rock and Roll had killed that one. Or how about the quiz shows? How about them? Tic-Tac-Doe and 21 every Monday night, starring Jack Barry. People going into isolation booths and putting UN-style earphones on their heads to hear fucking incredible questions they had already been briefed on. The $64,000 question with Hal March. Contestants staggering off stage with their arms full of reference books. Dotto with Jack Nars. And Saturday morning programs like Annie Oakley, who was always saving her kid brother Tag from some Christless mess. He had always wondered if that kid was really her bastard. There was Rin Tin Tin, who operated out of Fort Apache. Sergeant Preston, who operated out of the Yukon, sort of a roving assignment, you might say. Range Rider, with Jock Mahoney. Wild Bill Hickok, with Guy Madison and Andy Devine as jingles. Mary would say, "Bart, if people knew you watched all that stuff, they'd think you were feeble. Honestly, a man your age." And he had always replied, "I want to be able to talk to my kids, kid." Except there had never been any kids, not really. The first one had been nothing but a dead mess. What was that old joke about putting wheels on miscarriages?
And the second had been Charlie, who it was best not to think of. I'll be seeing you in my dreams, Charlie. Every night, it seemed he and his son got together in one dream or another. Barton George Dawes and Charles Frederick Dawes, reunited by the wonders of the subconscious mind. And here we are, folks, back in Disney World's newest head trip, Self-Pity Land, where you can take a gondola ride down the Canal of Tears, visit the Museum of Old Snapshots, and go for a ride in the wonderful Nostalgia-mobile, driven by Fred McMurray. The last stop on your tour is this wonderful replica of Crest Allen Street West. It's right here inside this giant Southwark comfort bottle, preserved for all time. That's right, madam. Just duck your head as you walk into the neck. It'll widen out soon. And this is the home of Barton George Dawes, the last living resident of Crest Allen Street West. Look right in the window here. Just a second, Sonny. I'll boost you up. That's George, all right, sitting in front of his Zenith color TV in his stupid boxer shorts, having a drink and crying. Crying? Of course he's crying. What else would he be doing in self-pity land? He cries all the time. The flow of his tears is regulated by our world-famous team of engineers. On Mondays, he just mists a little, because that's a slow night. The rest of the week, he cries a lot more. On the weekend, he goes into overdrive. And on Christmas, we may float him right away. I admit, he's a little disgusting, but nonetheless, he's one of Self-Pity Land's most popular inhabitants, right up there with our recreation of King Kong atop the Empire State Building. He threw his drink at the television. He missed by quite a bit. The glass hit the wall, fell to the floor, and shattered. He burst into fresh tears. Crying, he thought. Look at me. Look at me. Jesus, you're disgusting. You're such a fucking mess, it's beyond belief. You spoiled your whole life and Mary's, too, and you sit here joking about it, you fucking waste. Jesus, Jesus, Jesus. He was halfway to the telephone before he could stop himself. The night before, drunk and crying, he had called Mary and begged her to come back. He had begged until she began to cry and hung up on him. It made him squirm and grin to think of it, that he had done such a god-awful, embarrassing thing. He went on to the kitchen, got the dustpan and the whisk broom, and went back to the living room. He shut off the TV and swept up the glass. He took it into the kitchen, weaving slightly, and dumped it into the trash. Then he stood there, wondering what to do next. He could hear the insectile buzz of the refrigerator, and it frightened him. He went to bed and dreamed. December 6, 1973. It was 3:30, and he was slamming up the turnpike toward home, doing 70. The day was clear and hard and bright, the temperature in the low 30s. Every day since Mary had left, he went for a long ride on the turnpike. In a way, it had become his surrogate work. It soothed him. When the road was unrolling in front of him, its edges clearly marked by the low early winter snowbanks on either side, he was without thought and at peace. Sometimes he sang along with the radio in a lusty, bellowing voice. Often on these trips he thought he should just keep going. Letting way lead on to way, getting gas on the credit card, he would drive south and not stop until he ran out of roads or out of land. Could you drive all the way to the tip of South America? He didn't know. But he always came back. He would get off the turnpike, eat hamburgers and french fries in some pickup restaurant, and then drive into the city, arriving at sunset or just past. He always drove down Stanton Street, parked and got out to look at whatever progress the 784 extension had made during the day. The construction company had mounted a special platform for rubberneckers, mostly old men and shoppers with an extra minute, and during the day it was always full. They lined up along the railing like clay ducks in a shooting gallery, the cold vapor pluming from their mouths, gawking at the bulldozers and graders and the surveyors with their sextants and tripods. He could cheerfully have shot all of them. But at night, with the temperatures down in the 20s,
with sunset a bitter orange line in the west and thousands of stars already pricking coldly through the firmament overhead, he could measure the road's progress alone and undisturbed. The moments he spent there were becoming very important to him. He suspected that, in an obscure way, the moments spent on the observation platform were recharging him, keeping him tied to a world of at least half sanity. In those moments before the evening's long plunge into drunkenness had begun, before the inevitable urge to call Mary struck, before he began the evening's activities in self-pity land, he was totally himself, coldly and blinkingly sober. He would curl his hands over the iron pipe and stare down at the construction until his fingers became as unfeeling as the iron itself, and it became impossible to tell where the world of himself, the world of human things, ended, and the outside world of tractors and cranes and observation platforms began. In those moments there was no need to blubber or pick over the rick-rack of the past that jumbled his memory. In those moments he felt his self pulsing warmly in the cold indifference of the early winter evening, a real person, perhaps still whole. Now, whipping up the turnpike at 70, still 40 miles away from the Westgate toll booths, he saw a figure standing in the breakdown lane just past exit 16, muffled up in a CPO coat and wearing a black knitted watch cap. The figure was holding up a sign that said, amazingly, in all this snow, Las Vegas. And underneath that, defiantly, or bust. He slammed on the power brake and felt the seatbelt strain a groove in his middle with the swift deceleration, a little exhilarated by the Richard Petty sound of his own squealing tires. He pulled over about 20 yards beyond the figure. It tucked its sign under its arm and ran toward him. Something about the way the figure was running told him the hitchhiker was a girl. The passenger door opened and she got in.
"Hey, thanks."
"Sure." He glanced in the rearview mirror and pulled out, accelerating back to 70. The road unrolled in front of him again.
"A long way to Vegas."
"It sure is."
She smiled at him, the stock smile for people that told her it was a long way to Vegas, and pulled off her gloves.
"Do you mind if I smoke?"
"No, go ahead."
She pulled out a box of Marlboros.
"Like one?"
"No, thanks."
She stuck a cigarette in her mouth, took a box of kitchen matches from her CPO pocket, lit her smoke, took a huge drag, and chuffed it out, fogging part of the windshield. Put Marlboros and matches away, loosened the dark blue scarf around her neck, and said,
"I appreciate the ride. It's cold out there."
"Were you waiting long?"
"About an hour. The last guy was drunk. Man, I was glad to get out."
He nodded. "I'll take you to the end of the turnpike."
"End?"
She looked at him.
"You're going all the way to Chicago?"
"What? Oh, no." He named his city.
"But the turnpike goes through there."
She pulled a Sunoco road map, dog-eared from much thumbing, from her other coat pocket.
"The map says so."
"Unfold it and look again." She did so. "What color is the part of the turnpike we're on now?"
"Green."
"What color is the part going through the city?"
"Dotted green. It's... oh, Christ. It's under construction."
"That's right. The world-famous 784 extension. Girl, you'll never get to Las Vegas if you don't read the key to your map."
She bent over it, her nose almost touching the paper. Her skin was clear, perhaps normally milky, but now the cold had brought a bloom to her cheeks and forehead. The tip of her nose was red, and a small drop of water hung beside her left nostril. Her hair was clipped short and not very well. A home job. A pretty chestnut color. Too bad to cut it. Worse to cut it badly. What was that Christmas story by O. Henry? The Gift of the Magi. Who did you buy a watch chain for, little wanderer?
"The solid green picks up at a place called Landy," she said. "How far is that from where this part ends?"
"About 30 miles.
"Oh, Christ."
She puzzled over the map some more. Exit 15 flashed by.
"What's the bypass road?"
she asked finally.
"It just looks like a snarl to me."
"Route 7's best,"
he said. It's at the last exit, the one they call Westgate. He hesitated. But you'd do better to just hang it up for the night. There's a Holiday Inn. You won't get there until almost dark, and you don't want to try hitching up Route 7 after dark.
Why not? She asked, looking over at him. Her eyes were green and disconcerting, an eye color you read about occasionally but rarely see.
It's a city bypass road, he said, taking charge of the passing lane and roaring past a whole line of vehicles doing 50. Several of them honked at him angrily. Four lanes with a little bitty concrete divider between them. Two lanes west toward Landy, two lanes east into the city. Lots of shopping centers and hamburger stands and bowling alleys and all that. Everybody is going in short hops. No one wants to stop.
Yeah, she sighed. Is there a bus to Landy?
There used to be a city bus, but it went bankrupt. I guess there must be a Greyhound.
Oh, fuck it.
She squidged the map back together and stuffed it into her pocket. She stared at the road, looking put out and worried. Can't afford a motel room?
Mister, I've got 13 bucks. I couldn't rent a doghouse.
You can stay at my house if you want, he said.
Yeah, and maybe you better let me out right here.
Never mind. I withdraw the offer.
Besides, what would your wife think?
She looked pointedly at the wedding ring on his finger. It was a look that suggested she thought he might also hang around school play yards after the monitor had gone home for the day. My wife and I are separated.
Recently?
Yes. As of December 1st.
And now you've got all these hang-ups that you could use some help with, she said.
There was contempt in her voice, but it was an old contempt, not aimed specifically at him.
Especially some help from a young chick.
I don't want to lay anybody, he said truthfully. I don't even think I could get it up. He realized he had just used two terms that he had never used before a woman in his life. But it seemed all right. Not good or bad, but all right, like discussing the weather.
Is that supposed to be a challenge? She asked.
She drew deeply on her cigarette and exhaled more smoke. No, he said. I suppose it sounds like a line if you're looking for lines. I suppose a girl on her own has to be looking for them all the time.
This must be part 3, she said.
There was still mild contempt and hostility in her tone, but now it was cut with a certain tired amusement.
How did a nice girl like you get in a car like this?
Ah, to hell with it, he said. You're impossible.
That's right. I am.
She snuffed her cigarette in his ashtray and then wrinkled her nose.
Look at this. Full of candy wrappers and cellophane and every other kind of shit. Why don't you get a litter bag?
Because I don't smoke. If you had just called ahead and said, Barton, old boy, I intend to be hitching the turnpike today, so give me a ride, would you? And by the way, clear the shit out of your ashtray because I intend to smoke, then I would have emptied it. Why don't you just throw it out the window? She was smiling.
You have a nice sense of irony.
It's my sad life.
Do you know how long it takes filter tips to biodegrade? 200 years, that's how long. By that time, your grandchildren will be dead.
He shrugged. You don't mind me breathing in your used carcinogens, screwing up the cilia in my lungs, but you don't want to throw a filter tip out into the turnpike. Okay.
What's that supposed to mean?
Nothing.
Listen, do you want to let me out? Is that it?
No, he said. Why don't we just talk about something neutral? The state of the dollar. The state of the Union. The state of Arkansas.
I think I'd rather catch a little nap, if you don't mind. It looks like I'm going to be up most of the night.
Fine. She tilted the watch cap over her eyes, folded her arms, and became still. After a few moments, her breathing deepened to long strokes. He looked at her in short snatches, shoplifting an image of her. She was wearing blue jeans, tight, faded, thin. They molded her legs closely enough to let him know that she wasn't wearing a second pair or long handles. They were long legs, folded under the dashboard for comfort, and they were probably blushing lobster red now, itching like hell. He started to ask her if her legs itched and then thought how it would sound. The thought of her hitchhiking all night on Route 7,
Either getting rides in short hops or not getting rides at all made him feel uncomfortable. Night, thin pants, temperatures in the 20s. Well, it was her business. If she got cold enough, she could go in someplace and warm up. No problem. They passed exits 14 and 13. He stopped looking at her and concentrated on his driving. The speedometer needle stayed pegged at 70, and he stayed in the passing lane. More cars honked at him. As they passed exit 12, a man in a station wagon, which bore a Keep It at 50 bumper sticker, honked 3 times and blipped his lights indignantly. He gave the station wagon the finger. With her eyes still closed, she said,
"You're going too fast. That's why they're honking."
"I know why they're doing it."
"But you don't care."
"No."
"Just another concerned citizen," she intoned, "doing his part to rid America of the energy squeeze."
"I don't give a tin weasel about the energy squeeze."
"So say we. So say we all."
"I used to drive at 55 on the turnpike. No more, no less. That's where my car got the best mileage. Now I'm protesting the trained dog ethic. Surely you read about it in your sociology courses. Or am I wrong? I took it for granted you were a college kid." She sat up.
"I was a sociology major for a while." "Well, sort of. But I never heard of the trained dog ethic."
"That's because I made it up."
"Oh, April Fool."
"Disgust." She slid back down in the seat and tilted the watch cap over her eyes again. "The trained dog ethic, first advanced by Barton George Dawes in late 1973, fully explains such mysteries as the monetary crisis, inflation, the Vietnam War, and the current energy crisis. Let us take the energy crisis as an example. The American people are the trained dogs, trained in this case to love oil-guzzling toys, cars, snowmobiles, large boats, dune buggies, motorcycles, minicycles, campers, and many, many more. In the years 1973 to 1980, we will be trained to hate energy toys. The American people love to be trained. Training makes them wag their tails. Use energy. Don't use energy. Go pee on the newspaper. I don't object to saving energy. I object to training. He found himself thinking of Mr. Piazzi's dog, who had first stopped wagging his tail, had then started rolling his eyes, and had then ripped out Luigi Brontocelli's throat. "Like Pavlov's dogs," he said. "They were trained to salivate at the sound of a bell. We've been trained to salivate when somebody shows us a Bombardier Skidoo with overdrive, or a Zenith color TV with a motorized antenna. I have one of those at my house. The TV has a Space Command gadget. You can sit in your chair and change the channels, hike the volume or lower it, turn it on or off. I stuck the gadget in my mouth once and pushed the on button, and the TV came right on. The signal went right through my brain and still did the job. Technology is wonderful."
"You're crazy," she said.
"I guess so." They passed exit 11.
"I think I'll go to sleep. Tell me when we get to the end."
"Okay." She folded her arms and closed her eyes again. They passed exit 10. "It isn't the trained dog ethic I object to anyway," he said. "It's the fact that the masters are mental, moral, and spiritual idiots."
"You're trying to soothe your conscience with a lot of rhetoric," she said with her eyes still closed. "Why don't you just slow down to 50? You'll feel better."
"I will not feel better." And he sped it out so vehemently that she sat up and looked at him.
"Are you all right?"
"I'm fine," he said. "I lost my wife and my job because either the world has gone crazy or I have. Then I'd pick up a hitchhiker, a 19-year-old kid, for Christ's sake, the kind that's supposed to take it for granted that the world's gone crazy, and she tells me it's me. The world is doing just fine. Not much oil, but other than that, just fine."
"I'm 21.
"Good for you," he said bitterly. "If the world's so sane, what's a kid like you doing hitchhiking to Las Vegas in the middle of winter? Planning to spend the whole night hitchhiking along Route 7 and probably getting frostbite in your legs because you're not wearing anything under those pants.
I am so wearing something underneath. What do you think I am?
I think you're stupid, he roared at her. You're going to freeze your ass off.
And then you won't be able to get a piece of it, right?
She inquired sweetly.
Oh, boy, he muttered.
Oh, boy.
They roared past the sedan, moving at 50. The sedan beeped at him.
Eat it, he yelled. Raw!
I think you better let me off right now, she said quietly.
Never mind, he said. I'm not going to crash us up. Go to sleep.
She looked at him distrustfully for a long second, then folded her arms and closed her eyes. They went past exit 9. They passed exit 2 at 4:05. The shadows stretching across the road had taken on the peculiar blue cast that is the sole property of winter shadows. Venus was already in the east. The traffic had thickened as they approached the city. He glanced over toward her and saw she was sitting up, looking out at the hurrying, indifferent automobiles. The car directly in front of them had a Christmas tree lashed to its roof rack. The girl's green eyes were very wide, and for a moment he fell into them and saw out of them in the perfect empathy that comes to human beings at mercifully infrequent intervals. He saw that all the cars were going to some place where it was warm, some place where there was business to transact or friends to greet or a loom of family life to pick up and stitch upon. He saw their indifference to strangers. He understood in a brief, cold instant of comprehension what Thomas Carlyle called the great dead locomotive of the world, rushing on and on. We're almost there? She asked.
15 minutes.
Listen, if I was hard on you...
No, I was hard on you. Listen, I've got nothing in particular to do. I'll take you around to Landy.
No.
Or I'll stick you in the Holiday Inn for the night. No strings attached. Merry Christmas and all that.
Are you really separated from your wife?
Yes.
And so recently?
Yes.
Has she got your kids?
We have no kids. They were coming up on the toll booths. Their green go-lights twinkled indifferently in the early twilight.
Take me home with you, then.
I don't have to do that. You don't have to.
I'd just as soon be with somebody tonight, she said. And I don't like to hitchhike at night. It's scary.
He slid up to a toll booth and rolled down his window, letting in cold air. He gave the toll taker his card and $1.90. He pulled out slowly. They passed a reflectorized sign that said, "Thank you for driving safely." "All right," he said cautiously. He knew he was probably wrong to keep trying to reassure her, probably achieving just the opposite effect, but he couldn't seem to help it. "Listen. It's just that the house is very lonely by myself. We can have supper, and then maybe watch TV and eat popcorn. You can have the upstairs bedroom, and I'll..." She laughed a little, and he glanced at her as they went around the clover leaf. But she was hard to see now, a little indistinct. She could have been something he dreamed. The idea bothered him.
"Listen," she said, "I better tell you this right now. That drunk I was riding with... I spent the night with him. He was going on to Stilson, where you picked me up. That was his price."
He paused for the red light at the foot of the clover leaf.
"My roommate told me it would be like that, but I didn't believe her. I wasn't going to fuck my way across the country, not me."
She looked at him fleetingly, but he still couldn't read her face in the gloom.
"But it's not people making you. It's being so disconnected from everything, like spacewalking. When you come into a big city and think of all the people in there, you want to cry. I don't know why, but you do. It gets so you'd spend the night picking some guy's bleeding pimples just to hear him breathe and talk."
"I don't care who you've been sleeping with," he said, and pulled out into traffic. Automatically, he turned onto Grand Street, heading for home past the 784 construction.
"This salesman," she said, "he's been married 14 years. He kept saying that while he was humping me. 14 years, Sharon," he keeps saying. 14 years, 14 years. He came in about 14 seconds.
She uttered a short bark of laughter, rueful and sad.
Is that your name, Sharon?
No. I guess that was his wife's name. He pulled over to the curb.
What are you doing?
She asked, instantly distrustful.
Nothing much, he said. This is part of going home. Get out if you want. I'll show you something.
They got out and walked over to the observation platform, now deserted. He laid his bare hands on the cold iron pipe of the railing and looked down. They had been undercoating today, he saw. The last 3 working days they had put down gravel, now undercoat. Deserted equipment, trucks and bulldozers and yellow backhoes, stood silently about in the shades of evening like a museum exhibit of dinosaurs. Here we have the vegetarian Stegosaurus, the flesh-eating Triceratops, the fearsome earth-munching diesel shovel. Bon appetit.
What do you think of it? He asked her.
Am I supposed to think something?
She was fencing, trying to figure this out.
You must think something, he said.
She shrugged.
It's road work. So what? They're building a road in a city I'll probably never be in again. What am I supposed to think? It's ugly.
Ugly, he echoed, relieved.
I grew up in Portland, Maine, she said. We lived in a big apartment building, and they put this shopping center up across the street.
Did they tear anything down to make it?
Huh?
Did they?
Oh, no. It was just a vacant lot with a big field behind it. I was just 6 or 7. I thought they were going to go on digging and ripping and plowing forever, and all I could think, it's funny, all I could think was the poor old earth. It's like they're giving it an enema, and they never asked if it wanted one, or if there was something wrong. I had some kind of an intestinal infection that year, and I was the block expert on enemas.
Oh, he said.
We went over one Sunday when they weren't working, and it was a lot like this. Very quiet, like a corpse that died in bed. They had part of the foundations laid, and there were all these yellow metal things sticking out of the cement.
Core rods.
Whatever. And there was lots of pipe and bundles of wire covered with clear plastic wrap. And there was a lot of raw dirt around. Funny to think of it that way. Whoever heard of cooked dirt? But that's how it looked. Just raw. We played hide-and-go-seek around the place, and my mother came over and got us and gave me and my sister hell for it. She said little kids can get into bad trouble around construction. My little sister was only 4, and she cried her head off. Funny to remember all that. Can we get back in the car now? I'm cold.
Sure, he said, and they did.
As they drove on, she said,
I never thought they'd have anything out of that place but a mess. Then pretty soon the shopping center was all there. I can remember the day they hot-topped the parking lot. And a few days after that, some men came with a little push wagon and made all the yellow parking lines. Then they had a big party, and some hot shit cut a ribbon, and everybody started using it. And it was just like they never built it. The name of the big department store was Mammoth Mart, and my mom used to go there a lot. Sometimes when Angie and I were with her, I'd think of all those orange rods sticking through the cement down in the basement. It was like a secret thought.
He nodded. He knew about secret thoughts.
What does it mean to you? She asked.
I'm still trying to figure that out, he said.
He was going to make TV dinners, but she looked in the freezer and saw the roast and said she'd fix it if he didn't mind waiting for it to cook.
Sure, he said. I didn't know how long to cook it, or even what temperature.
Do you miss your wife?
Like hell.
Because you don't know how to cook the roast? She asked.
And he didn't answer that. She baked potatoes and cooked frozen corn. They ate in the breakfast nook, and she ate 4 thick slices of the roast, 2 potatoes and 2 helpings of corn.
I haven't eaten like that in a year, she said,
lighting a cigarette and looking into her empty plate.
I'll probably heave my guts.
What have you been eating?
Animal crackers.
What?
Animal crackers.
I thought that's what you said.
They're cheap,
she said, and they fill you up. They've got a lot of nutrients and stuff, too. It says so right on the box.
Nutrients, my ass. You're getting zits, girl. You're too old for those. Come here.
He led her into the dining room and opened Mary's china cupboard. He took out a silver serving dish and pulled a thick pile of paper money out of it. Her eyes widened.
Who'd you off, mister?
I offed my insurance policy. Here's $200. Eat on it.
But she didn't touch the money.
You're nuts, she said. What do you think I'm going to do to you for $200?
Nothing.
She laughed.
All right.
He put the money on the sideboard and put the silver serving dish back into the cupboard.
If you don't take it with you in the morning, I'll flush it down the john.
But he didn't think he would.
She looked into his face. You know, I think you would.
He said nothing.
We'll see, she said, in the morning.
In the morning, he echoed.
He was watching To Tell the Truth on the television. Two of the contestants were lying about being the world's champion female bronc rider, and one was telling the truth. The panel, which included Soupy Sales, Bill Cullen, Arlene Dahl, and Kitty Carlisle, had to guess which one was telling the truth. Gary Moore, television's only 300-year-old game show host, smiled and cracked jokes and dinged a bell when each panelist's time was up. The girl was looking out the window.
Hey, she said, who lives on this street anyway? All the houses look dark.
Me and the Dankmans, he said, and the Dankmans are moving out January 5th.
Why?
The road, he said. Would you like a drink?
What do you mean, the road?
It's coming through here, he said. This house is going to be somewhere in the middle of the median strip, as near as I can figure.
That's why you showed me the construction?
I guess so. I used to work for a laundry about 2 miles from here. The Blue Ribbon. It's going through there, too.
That's why you lost your job? Because the laundry was closing?
Not exactly. I was supposed to sign an option on a new plant in a suburb called Waterford, and I didn't do it.
Why not?
I couldn't bear to, he said simply. You want a drink?
You don't have to get me drunk, she said.
Oh, Christ, he said, rolling his eyes. Your mind runs on just one track, doesn't it?
There was a moment of uncomfortable silence.
Screwdrivers are about the only drinks I like. Do you have vodka and orange juice?
Yes.
No pot, I guess.
No, I've never used it.
He went out into the kitchen and made her a screwdriver. He mixed himself a Comfort and 7-Up and took them back into the living room. She was playing with the Space Command gadget, and the TV switched from channel to channel, displaying its 7:30 wares To Tell the Truth, Snow, What's My Line, I Dream of Jeannie, Gilligan's Island, Snow, I Love Lucy, Snow, Snow, Julia Child making something with avocados that looked a little like dog whoop, The New Price is Right, Snow, and then back to Gary Moore, who was daring the panel to discover which of the three contestants was the real author of a book about what it was like to be lost for a month in the forests of Saskatchewan. He gave her her drink.
Did you eat beetles, number two? Kitty Carlisle asked. What's the matter with you people? The girl asked. No Star Trek. Are you heathens?
They run it at 4 o'clock on Channel 8, he said.
Do you watch it?
Sometimes. My wife always watches Merv Griffin.
I didn't see any beetles, number two said. If I'd seen any, I would have eaten them.
The audience laughed heartily.
Why did she move out? You don't have to tell me if you don't want to.
She looked at him warily, as if the price of his confession might be tiresomely high.
The same reason I got fired off my job, he said, sitting down.
Because you didn't buy that plant?
No, because I didn't buy a new house.
I voted for number two, Soupy Sales said, because he looks like he'd eat a beetle if he saw one.
The audience laughed heartily.
didn't... Wow. Oh, wow.
She looked at him over her drink without blinking. The expression in her eyes seemed to be a mixture of awe, admiration, and terror.
Where are you going to go?
I don't know.
You're not working?
No.
What do you do all day?
I ride on the turnpike.
And watch TV at night?
And drink. Sometimes I make popcorn. I'm going to make popcorn later on tonight.
I don't eat popcorn.
Then I'll eat it. She punched the off button on the space command gadget. He sometimes thought of it as a module, because today you were encouraged to think of everything that zapped on and off as a module. And the picture on the zenith twinkled down to a bright dot and then winked out.
Let me see if I've got this straight, she said. You threw your wife and your job down the drain.
But not necessarily in that order.
Whatever. You threw them away over this road. Is that right?
He looked at the blank TV uncomfortably. Even though he rarely followed what was happening on it very closely, it made him uncomfortable to have it off. I don't know if it is or not, he said. You can't always understand something just because you did it.
Was it a protest?
I don't know. If you're protesting something, it's because you think something else would be better. All those people protested the war because they thought peace would be better. People protest drug laws because they think other drug laws would be fairer or more fun or less harm or... I don't know. Why don't you turn the TV on?
In a minute.
He noticed again how green her eyes were, intent, cat-like.
Is it because you hate the road? The technological society it represents? The dehumanizing effect of...
No, he said. It was so difficult, to be honest. And he wondered why he was even bothering when a lie would end the discussion so much more quickly and neatly. She was like the rest of the kids, like Vinny, like the people who thought education was truth. She wanted propaganda, complete with charts, not an answer.
I've seen them building roads and buildings all my life. I never even thought about it. Except it was a pain in the ass to use a detour or have to cross the street because the sidewalk was ripped up or the construction company was using a wrecking ball.
But when it hit home, to your house and your job, you said no.
I said no, all right. But he wasn't sure what he had said no to. Or had he said yes? Yes. Finally, yes to some destructive impulse that had been part of him all along. As much a built-in self-destruct mechanism as Charlie's tumor. He found himself wishing Freddy would come around. Freddy could tell her what she wanted to hear, but Fred had been playing it cool.
You're either crazy or really remarkable, she said.
People are only remarkable in books, he said. Let's have the TV. She turned it on. He let her pick the show.
What are you drinking?
It was 9:15. He was tipsy, but not as drunk as he would have been by now alone. He was making popcorn in the kitchen. He liked to watch it pop in the tempered glass popper, rising and rising like snow that had sprung up from the ground rather than come down from the sky. Southern Comfort and 7-Up, he said.
What?
He chuckled, embarrassed.
Can I try one?
She showed him her empty glass and grinned. It was the first completely unselfconscious expression she had shown him since he had picked her up.
You make a lousy screwdriver.
I know, he said. Comfort and 7-Up is my private drink. In public, I stick to scotch. Hate scotch. The popcorn was done, and he poured it into a large plastic bowl.
Can I have one?
Sure. He mixed her a Comfort and 7-Up, then poured a melted stick of butter over the popcorn.
That's going to put a lot of cholesterol in your bloodstream, she said,
leaning on the doorway between the kitchen and the dining room. She sipped her drink.
Hey, I like this.
Sure you do. Keep it a secret, and you'll always be 1-Up. He salted the popcorn.
That cholesterol clogs up your heart, she said.
The passageways for the blood get smaller and smaller, and then one day...
She clutched dramatically at her bosom and spilled some of her drink on her sweater. "I metabolize it all the way," he told her, and went through the doorway. He brushed her breast, primly broad by the feel, on the way by. It felt a way Mary's breast hadn't felt in years. It was maybe not such a good way to think. She ate most of the popcorn. She started to yawn during the 11 o'clock news, which was mostly about the energy crisis and the White House tapes. "Go on upstairs," he said. "Go to bed." She gave him a look. He said, "We're going to get along good if you stop looking like somebody goosed you every time the word bed comes up. The primary purpose of the great American bed is sleeping, not intercoursing." That made her smile.
"You don't even want to turn down the sheets?"
"You're a big girl."
She looked at him calmly. "You can come up with me if you want," she said. "I decided that an hour ago."
"No, but you don't have any idea how attractive the invitation is. I've only slept with 3 women in my entire life, and the first 2 were so long ago I can hardly remember them, before I was married."
"Are you kidding?"
"Not at all."
"Listen, it wouldn't be just because you gave me a ride or let me sleep over or anything like that, or the money you offered."
"It's good of you to say that," he said, and got up. "You better go up now."
But she didn't follow his suit. "You ought to know why you're not doing it."
"I should?"
"Yes. If you do things and can't explain them, like you said, that might be okay because they still get done. But if you decide not to, you ought to know why."
"All right," he said. He nodded toward the dining room where the money still lay in the silver dish. "It's the money. You're too young to be off whoring."
"I won't take it,"
she said promptly. "I know you won't. That's why I won't. I want you to take it."
"Because everybody isn't as nice as you?"
"That's right." He looked at her challengingly. She shook her head in an exasperated way and stood up.
"All right. But you're a bourgeois, you know that?"
"Yes." She came over and kissed him on the mouth. It was exciting. He could smell her, and the smell was nice. He was almost instantly hard. "Go on," he said.
"If you reconsider during the night..."
"I won't." He watched her go to the stairs, her feet bare. "Hey." She turned, her eyebrows raised. "What's your name?"
"Olivia, if it matters. Stupid, isn't it? Like Olivia de Havilland."
"No, it's okay. I like it. Night, Olivia."
"Night."
She went up. He heard the light click on, the way he had always heard it when Mary went up before him. If he listened closely, he might be able to hear the quietly maddening sound of her sweater against her skin as she pulled it up over her head, or the snap of the catch that held her jeans nipped into her waist. Using the Space Command module, he turned on the TV. His penis was still fully erect, uncomfortable. It bulged against the crotch of his pants, what Mary had sometimes called the rock of ages and sometimes the snake that turned to stone in their younger days, when bed was nothing but another playground sport. He pulled at the folds of his underwear, and when it didn't go down, he stood up. After a while, the erection wilted, and he sat down again. When the news was over, a movie came on, John Agar in Brain from Planet Eros. He fell asleep, sitting in front of the TV with the Space Command module still clasped loosely in one hand. A few minutes later, there was a stirring beneath the fly of his pants as his erection returned, stealthily, like a murderer revisiting the scene of an ancient crime. December 7, 1973. But he did go to her in the night. The dream of Mr. Piazzi's dog came to him. And this time he knew the boy approaching the dog was Charlie before the bitch struck. That made it worse. And when Mr. Piazzi's dog lunged, he struggled up from sleep like a man clawing his way out of a shallow, sandy grave. He clawed at the air, not awake but not asleep either.
and he lost his sense of balance on the couch, where he had finally curled up. He tottered miserably on the edge of balance for a moment, disoriented, terrified for his dead son who died over and over again in his dreams. He fell onto the floor, banging his head and hurting his shoulder, and came awake enough to know he was in his own living room and that the dream was over. The reality was miserable, but not actively terrifying. What was he doing? A sort of gestalt reality of what he had done to his life came to him, a hideous overview. He had ripped it right down the middle, like a cheap piece of cloth. Nothing was right anymore. He was hurting. He could taste stale southern comfort in the back of his throat, and he burped up some acid-tasting sour stuff and swallowed it back. He began to shiver and seized his knees in a futile effort to stop it. In the night, everything was strange. What was he doing, sitting on the floor of his living room and holding his knees and shaking like an old drunk in an alley? Or like a catatonic, a fucking psycho, that was more like it. Was that it? Was he a psycho? Nothing sort of funny and whimsical like a fruitcake or a dork or a rubber crutch, but an out-and-out psycho? The thought dumped him into fresh terror. Had he gone to a hoodlum in an effort to get explosives? Was he really hiding two guns out in the garage, one of them big enough to kill an elephant? A little whining noise came out of his throat, and he got up, tentatively, his bones creaking like those of a very old man. He went up the stairs without allowing himself to think, and stepped into his bedroom. "Olivia," he whispered. This was preposterous, like an old-time Rudolph Valentino movie. "Are you awake?"
"Yes," she said. She didn't even sound sleepy. "The clock was keeping me awake. That digital clock. It kept going click. I pulled the plug."
"That's all right," he said. It was a ludicrous thing to say. "I had a bad dream." The sound of covers being thrown back.
"Come on. Get in with me."
"I..."
"Will you shut up?"
He got in with her. She was naked. They made love. Then slept. In the morning, the temperature was only 10 degrees. She asked him if he got a newspaper. "We used to," he said. "Kenny Upslinger delivered it. His family moved to Iowa."
"Iowa yet?" she said, and turned on the radio.
A man was giving the weather, clear and cold. "Would you like a fried egg?"
"2, if you've got them."
"Sure. Listen, about last night..."
"Never mind last night. I came. That's very rare for me. I enjoyed it."
He felt a certain sneaking pride, maybe what she had wanted him to feel. He fried the eggs, 2 for her, 2 for him, toast and coffee. She drank 3 cups with cream and sugar.
"So, what are you going to do?"
she asked him when they had both finished. "Take you out to the highway," he said promptly. She made an impatient gesture.
"Not that. About your life."
He grinned. "That sounds serious."
"Not for me," she said. "For you."
"I haven't thought about it," he said. "You know, before..." He accented the word before slightly, to indicate all of his life and all of its parts he had sailed off the edge of the world. "Before the axe fell, I think I must have felt the way some condemned man feels in the death house. Nothing seemed real. It seemed I was living in a glass dream that would go on and on. Now, everything seems real. Last night, that was very real."
"I'm glad," she said, and she looked glad. "But what will you do now?"
"I really don't know." She said,
"I think that's sad."
"Is it?" he asked. It was a real question. They were in the car again, driving Route 7 toward Landy. The traffic near the city was stop and go. People were on their way to work. When they passed the construction on the 784 extension, the day's operation was already cranking up. Men in yellow high-impact plastic construction hats and green rubber boots were climbing into their machines, frozen breath pluming from their mouths. The engine of one of the Orange City payloaders cranked, cranked, kicked over with a coughing mortar explosion sound, cranked again, then roared into a choppy idle. The driver gunned it in irregular bursts like the sound of warfare.
"From up here they look like little boys playing trucks in a sand pile," she said.
Outside the city, traffic smoothed out. She had taken the $200 with neither embarrassment nor reluctance, with no special eagerness, either. She had slit a small section of the CPO coat's lining, had put the bills inside, and had then sewed the slit back up with a needle and some blue thread from Mary's sewing box. She had refused his offer of a ride to the bus station, saying the money would last longer if she went on hitching. "So what's a nice girl like you doing in a car like this?" he asked.
"Hmm?"
She looked at him, bumped out of her own thoughts. He smiled. "Why you? Why Las Vegas? You're living in the margins, same as me. Give me some background." She shrugged.
"There isn't much. I was going to college at the University of New Hampshire, in Durham. That's near Portsmouth. I was a junior this year, living off campus with a guy. We got into a heavy drug thing."
"You mean like heroin?" She laughed merrily.
"No, I've never known anyone who did heroin. Us nice middle-class druggies stick to the hallucinogens, lysergic acid, mescaline, peyote a couple of times, STP a couple of times, chemicals. I did 16 or 18 trips between September and November."
"What's it like?" he asked.
"Do you mean, did I have any bad trips?"
"No, I didn't mean that at all," he said defensively.
"There were some bad trips, but they all had good parts. And a lot of the good trips had bad parts. Once I decided I had leukemia, that was scary. But mostly they were just strange. I never saw God. I never wanted to commit suicide. I never tried to kill anyone."
She thought that over for a minute.
"Everybody has hyped the shit out of those chemicals. The straights, people like Art Linkletter, say they'll kill you. The freaks say they'll open all the doors you need to open. Like you can find a tunnel into the middle of yourself, as if your soul was like the treasure in an H. Rider Haggard novel. Have you ever read him?"
"I read She when I was a kid. Didn't he write that?"
"Yes. Do you think your soul is like an emerald in the middle of an idol's forehead?"
"I never thought about it."
"I don't think so,"
she said.
"I'll tell you the best and the worst that ever happened to me on chemicals. The best was topping out in the apartment one time and watching the wallpaper. There were all these little round dots on the wallpaper, and they turned into snow for me. I sat in the living room and watched the snowstorm on the wall for better than an hour. And after a while, I saw this little girl trudging through the snow. She had a kerchief on her head, a very rough material like burlap, and she was holding it like this."
She made a fist under her chin.
"I decided she was going home, and bang! I saw a whole street in there, all covered with snow. She went up the street, and then up a walk, and into a house. That was the best, sitting in the apartment and watching Wall-O-Vision, except Jeff called it Head-O-Vision."
"Was Jeff the guy you were living with?"
"Yes. The worst trip was one time I decided to plunge out the sink. I didn't know why. You get funny ideas sometimes when you're tripping, except they seem perfectly normal. It seemed like I had to plunge the sink. So I got the plunger and did it. And all this shit came out of the drain. I still don't know how much of it was real shit and how much was head shit. Coffee grounds, an old piece of shirt, great big hunks of congealed grease, red stuff that looked like blood, and then the hand. Some guy's hand."
What?
"A hand. I called to Jeff and said, 'Hey, somebody put somebody down the drain.' But he had taken off someplace and I was alone. I plunged like hell and finally got the forearm out. The hand was lying on the porcelain, all spotted with coffee grounds, and there was the forearm going right down the drain. I went into the living room for a minute to see if Jeff had come back, and when I went into the kitchen again, the arm and the hand was gone. It sort of worried me. Sometimes I dream about it."
That's crazy, he said, slowing down as they crossed the bridge that was under construction.
Chemicals make you crazy, she said. Sometimes that's a good thing. Mostly it isn't. Anyway, we were into this heavy drug thing. Have you ever seen one of those drawings of what an atom looks like? With the protons and neutrons and electrons going around?
Yes.
Well, it was like our apartment was the nucleus, and all the people who drifted in and out were the protons and electrons. People coming and going, drifting in and out, all disconnected. Like in Manhattan Transfer.
I haven't read that one. You ought to.
Jeff always said Dos Passos was the original gonzo journalist. Freaky book. Anyway, some nights we'd be sitting around watching TV with the sound shut off and a record on the stereo. Everyone stoned, people bawling in the bedroom, maybe. And you wouldn't even know who the fuck everyone was, you know what I mean?
Thinking of some of the parties he had wandered drunkenly through, as bemused as Alice in Wonderland, he said that he did.
So one night there was a Bob Hope special on, and everybody was sitting around, all smoked up, laughing like hell at all those old one-liners, all those same stock expressions, all that good-natured kidding of the power crazies in Washington, just sitting around the tube like all the mommies and daddies back home. And I thought, well, that's what we went through Vietnam for, so Bob Hope could close the generation gap. It's just a question of how you're getting high.
But you were too pure for all that.
Pure? No, that wasn't it. But I started to think of the last 15 years or so like some kind of grotesque monopoly game. Francis Gary Powers gets shut down in his U2, lose one turn. Niggers dispersed by fire hoses in Selma go directly to jail. Freedom riders shotgunned in Mississippi, marches, rallies, Lester Maddox with his axe handle, Kennedy getting blown up in Dallas, Vietnam, more marches, Kent State, student strikes, women's liberation, and all for what? So a bunch of heads can sit around stoned in a crummy apartment, watching Bob Hope? Fuck that. So I decided to split.
What about Jeff? She shrugged.
He has a scholarship. He's doing good. He says he's going to come out next summer, but I won't look for him until I see him.
There was a peculiar disillusioned expression on her face that probably felt like hearty forbearance on the inside. Do you miss him?
Every night.
Why Vegas? Do you know someone out there?
No.
It seems like a funny place for an idealist.
Is that what you think I am?
She laughed and lit a cigarette.
Maybe. But I don't think an ideal needs any particular setting. I want to see that city. It's so different from the rest of the country that it must be good. But I'm not going to gamble. I'm just going to get a job.
Then what? She blew out smoke and shrugged. They were passing a sign that said, Landy, 5 miles.
Try to get something together, she said. I'm not going to put any dope in my head for a long time, and I'm going to quit these.
She gestured her cigarette in the air, and it made an accidental circle, as if it knew a different truth.
I'm going to stop pretending my life hasn't started yet. It has. It's 20% over. I've drunk the cream.
Look, there's the turnpike entrance. He pulled over to the side.
What about you, man? What are you going to do?
Carefully, he said. See what develops. Keep my options open. She said,
You're not in such hot shape, if you don't mind me saying so.
No, I don't mind.
Here, take this.
She was holding out a small aluminum packet between the first and second fingers of her right hand. He took it and looked at it. The foil caught the bright morning sun and heliographed darts of light at his eyes.
What is it?
Product 4 synthetic mescaline, the heaviest, cleanest chemical ever made. She hesitated. Maybe you should just flush it down the john when you get home. It might fuck you up worse than you are, but it might help. I've heard of it.
Have you ever seen it? She smiled bitterly.
No.
Will you do something for me, if you can?
If I can.
Call me on Christmas Day.
Why?
You're like a book I haven't finished. I want to know how a little more of it comes out. Make it a collect call. Here, I'll write down the number. He was fumbling a pen out of his pocket when she said,
No.
He looked at her puzzled and hurt.
No? I can get the number from directory assistance if I need it, but maybe it would be best not to.
Why?
I don't know. I like you, but it's like someone put a hurtin' on you. I can't explain. It's like you were going to do something really bonkers.
You think I'm a fruitcake, he heard himself say. Well, fuck you. She got out of the car stiffly. He leaned over. Olivia.